Welcome to the podcast of The Diane Rehm Show, smart conversation and civil dialogue from WAMU and NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the completely redesigned 300-horsepower MDX. More information is available at Acura.com.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. In 1991, Norway awarded the Nobel Peace Prize to Burmese pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The prize focused the world's attention on the repressive rule of a military dictatorship in the Asian nation of 45 million people. But 16 years, international condemnation, and dedicated albums by U2 and REM have made little difference. Joining me in the studio to make the case for understanding Burma's history, to move toward improving its future, is Thant Minh Thu. He's written a new book titled The River of Lost Footsteps. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
We're going to invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. Our toll-free number is 1-800-433-8850. Or you can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Now, you talk about the nation of Burma. Its name was changed some years ago, I guess, 1989, to Myanmar. Why was the name changed, and why do you choose to continue to refer to it as Burma?
The government, the military government, changed the name from Burma to Myanmar officially in English, and that's how it's used, say, at the United Nations. But Myanmar was always the Burmese name for Burma, and it's the old name. And even though it sounds very different, it's actually the same word. Myanmar in colloquial Burmese is pronounced Bama, which was then changed by the Portuguese and the French and the British when they arrived a few hundred years ago into Burma. So it's a corruption of the same name, like Kampuchea and Cambodia, for example. And I just, it's not a political thing for me. I just prefer Burma to Myanmar in its pronunciation.
Now, we had a vote in the United Nations about a resolution that would have condemned the government, the military government in Burma. Russia and China blocked that effort by the U.S. Was this vote important, do you think?
I suppose it's important. I think anything that's at the Security Council is important for the countries concerned. It wasn't really a surprise. I think China in particular and Russia to some extent had made it very clear for a long time that they opposed in principle the idea of taking the Burma case to the Security Council because they didn't feel that the various problems in Burma, which I think they recognize up to a point, do not constitute a threat to international peace and security.
You have made the point, I'm sure surprising to some, that while you very much support democratic reform in Burma, you did not think this resolution or sanctions is really the most effective thing to do.
I think in general I oppose the use, or I think that the use of sanctions, condemnation, boycotts over the last 15 years have not worked. I think that's obvious to see. And I think that an argument can be made that they have been counterproductive and they're not the way to go for a number of different reasons.
Now, you're a Burmese American yourself, born in the United States. Your grandfather, your maternal grandfather, the Secretary General of the UN, tell us about growing up. You grew up in New York, but it could not have been a more Burmese kind of atmosphere to your home.
My grandfather had moved here in the late 1950s when he was actually first the Burmese ambassador to the UN. And he was elected Secretary General in 61, and he served for 10 years until 71, after the death of his predecessor, Dag Hammarskjöld. And so I was born in the middle of that period in 1966 at our home, which was in Riverdale, just outside of Manhattan. And it was with my parents and my grandparents, my grandfather and my grandmother, and a whole bunch of other Burmese people lived there in a sort of big compound, which was really almost a slice of Burma in many ways. We had lots of Burmese people always visiting and staying with us. Aung San Suu Kyi actually was working at the UN during part of that time, and she would come to visit as well. So in that little space in the 6 acres that we had in Riverdale, it was in some ways, except for the snow outside, it was as much growing up in Burma as it was growing up in New York.
And when was the first time you went to Burma?
That was in the end of 1974 when I was 8 years old, and my grandfather had just died in November of that year.
And what was it like when you went there? Did the country surprise you? You'd heard so much about it, but you'd never been there?
I guess so. I mean, I was so young at that time. But in some ways, some things that I saw in the country were so familiar because I had grown up in this Burmese household. And yet some things were obviously very different because I had never been there. Everyone was unfamiliar. I didn't know any of my relatives there at the time. But some little things, and I spoke Burmese fluently, for example, and some little things about the culture were already very intimately familiar, having grown up, despite having grown up in New York.
Now, you went there for your grandfather's funeral, but it became a very political moment. Tell us what happened.
My grandfather was already seen by the military dictatorship and the military dictator at the time, General Ne Win, as a political opponent. He had been an important member of the last democratic government in Burma, which had ruled the country in the 1950s. And so even though he had cordial relations with General Ne Win through the 60s, he was always held with a certain amount of suspicion. And when he died in 1974, General Ne Win decided that there would be no official honors, there would be no state recognition, and that he asked instead that my family simply bury him at a small private cemetery outside the city. And my family agreed to that, but thousands or hundreds or thousands of university students and others decided that that was unacceptable. And in the middle of the funeral procession in early December 1974, they decided to seize the coffin which carried his remains, his body, and they took the body to the site of the old student union at the university, which had been blown up by the military. And quickly, over a period of hours, a day or so, what had been an attempt by these students to properly honor my grandfather in a big public funeral became also the worst or the biggest challenge to the military government in over a decade.
What did the family think about that? I mean, it's obviously a time of great grief when a member of the family dies. What was that like for members of the family?
I think for my parents, for example, and for my other relatives, I mean, in a way, they were extremely sympathetic to the students. They were very honored and touched in a way by this huge outpouring of emotion and tribute in a way to my grandfather. But at the same time, they were deeply shocked at the violence that was taking place around his burial. They tried for several days, my father and my grandfather's younger brothers, to negotiate between the university students and the government and the military. This was at a time when thousands of people were then camping out at the university, monks, students, ordinary people, tributes, speeches were being made, but also denunciations of the government. And there was an agreement for a while, but then that agreement fell through when a number of students also injected political demands. The agreement would have included an amnesty for the students, but it would have included a public burial and a mausoleum for my grandfather in a proper place in the center of the city. And the government, I suppose, reached the limits of its patience, or General Ne Win did, on the fourth day or the fifth day. And on the morning of that day, his army stormed the university, killing probably a number of students, perhaps a dozen, perhaps more students, seizing the coffin back, and then burying the body in the center of the city at a place that had been agreed with my family. But this led to riots and greater bloodshed. We still don't know at all to this day how many people might have been killed around those days. And then we were asked to leave, and we left a couple of weeks later.
And where is your grandfather buried now?
He is buried at the site that was agreed in this agreement that had fallen through. So at a fairly good public place in the center of the city, very close to the Shwedagon Pagoda, which is the main sort of site of Burmese Buddhism. It's a huge pagoda in the center of Rangoon. It's at the foothills, not the foothills, but at the bottom on a street, a big public street, towards the bottom of the pagoda, next to Aung San Suu Kyi's mother, who's buried there, and next to the last queen of Burma, who's also buried there.
What a historic place. Is it still a gathering place or a symbolic place for pro-democracy protesters?
It's a very symbolic place, and because it's such a symbolic place, people shun it completely. Because people are very worried about, there is a lot of political repression in the country. People are very worried about not wanting to seem to be making public statements against the military. And I think visiting either my grandfather's mausoleum or Aung San Suu Kyi's mother's tomb would be seen as a form of political protest even now.
Our phone lines are open. We welcome your calls. Give us a call on our toll-free line, 1-800-433-8850. You can always send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. You go to Burma regularly now. What is it like there now?
It's very difficult to give a generalization. I mean, I think, you know, what we hear from the outside, that there is a lot of political repression, that there's really close to no political freedom, that there are political prisoners, over 1,000 political prisoners. All that is true. But I think in a way, only to look at that would give people an erroneous impression of the country as a whole. It is, after all, a country of 55, 56 million people. It's a very young country. Half the population is 18 years old or under. The military is very repressive in its space, in the sense that if you're a dissident, if you stand up on a street corner and you denounce the military, if you try to write something against the military, you will almost certainly be locked up and put in jail for a while. But there's a whole part of Burmese society which is actually very independent from the military. There is, and you see this when you go there is still a very lively art scene, literature scene, music scene. There's a lot happening in the world of religion and culture and other things in the country as well, which in a way is very separate from the military. As long as it's apolitical, it's fairly autonomous from the military and from the military's repression. So it's a very dynamic society in many ways, but it's also a society which is sadly also still very extremely poor. And that has caused tremendous problems, especially in recent years.
And, of course, a lot of the attention in the United States has been on the plight of Aung San Suu Kyi. Tell us what is happening with her these days.
She had emerged in 1988 when there were huge pro-democracy demonstrations as a leader of those demonstrations. And quickly after those demonstrations were crushed, she had emerged as the key opposition figure in the country. And in 1990, the government had held elections. And when her party won those elections, they had refused to essentially respect the results of those elections. The last 15 years, in a way, has been this sort of battle of wills between her and the military. But she has been under house arrest quite a lot of that time. She remains under house arrest. And sadly, in many ways, the military very much has the upper hand, I think, against the political opposition in Rangoon. I think what is missed by that story, in a way, though, is the other sort of political story in Burma, which is almost completely unreported, which is that there has been a civil war in Burma as well, completely different from this democracy versus dictatorship sort of struggle.
We're going to talk about that civil war when we come back. First, we're going to take a short break. Then we'll continue our conversation with Thant Mien Thu about his new book. It's called The River of Lost Footsteps, Histories of Burma. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking about a new book, The River of Lost Footsteps, Histories of Burma. The author, Thant Mien Thu, is with me here in the studio. We're going to take your calls in just a few minutes, 1-800-433-8850. Before the break, you mentioned that there has been very little attention in the United States and the West to the civil war that is going on in Burma. How did it start?
It started actually a very long time ago, in 1948, 1949, when Burma was on the eve of its independence from Britain. It was part of the British Empire, British India, for over 100 years. And it is today the longest-running war anywhere in the world. It involves not just the government and a single insurgency. It involves the government and at least 18 different insurgencies, some of them with over 20,000 troops, well-armed troops, so double perhaps the size of the Taliban in Afghanistan. And at different times in Burma's recent history, in the 1950s and 60s and 70s and 80s, it was a very major war in the sense that it threatened major cities in Burma. And there was a period, actually, when the government held only Rangoon and nothing else, and the whole rest of the country was under different insurgent controls. And these were both communists for a long time, but also ethnic minority insurgent groups. What has happened, and this is almost entirely unreported outside, is in the last 15 years, the government and nearly all the insurgent groups have agreed to ceasefires. So over the 1990s, for the very first time in Burma's history since independence, the guns have gone almost entirely silent everywhere in the country, except in the southwest on the Thai border, where they're still fighting against the Karen National Union, which is one of the bigger insurgent groups. And I think my point on that is that while it's important to focus on the lack of democracy and the human rights problems at the center with the political prisoners, it's also important to see Burma as a war-torn society with a long history of civil war, hopefully coming out of that civil war, and that and the political repression and the poverty all need to be looked at together in a more complex approach to the country than just to focus on human rights and the lack of democracy.
Why do you think the civil war has gotten so little attention?
I think it's partly that it's very difficult to go into the country and report on it as a journalist. There's almost no television cameras allowed in Burma in general, much less in these very sensitive parts of the country. But I think in general because there is a whole strain of exoticism about Burma. I think people see it as a very exotic country. And in 1988, people knew very little about the history of the country. And so it's been very easy within that framework to pour in this fairly easy to understand story about democracy and the lack of democracy, as opposed to the real complexities that there are in the country with the war, with poverty, with the repression and many other things as well.
Now, this would be why you are concerned about efforts by the United Nations, for instance, this resolution that failed on Sunday to focus only on the democracy aspect.
I think the UN resolution, the draft resolution, did cover a lot of ground. I'm more critical in a way of attempts over the last 10, 15 years in the West to simply see condemnation and boycotts and sanctions as a way that will change Burma for the better. I think that if you took the broader view and saw the complexities of the issues, and if you understood that sanctions in the end mean only Western sanctions, because the idea that China will impose sanctions on Burma to promote democracy in Burma, I think will never happen. And in a way, Western countries lessening their influence in Burma in a way that China and other countries in the region are sort of going, I don't think that that's a recipe for democratic change. And also, I think sanctions assumes a kind of government very unlike the government that exists, the government that would actually respond to that sort of pressure. I don't think this government will.
The ability to have these ceasefires through much of the country, has that strengthened the hand of the military government?
In many ways, it has. For the military, the history of recent times is not the history of a democracy movement held down. For them, the central narrative of the last 15 years is the Burmese army, after 60 years of fighting, finally breaking the back of its battlefield enemies. And they feel, in a way, in a much more confident and comfortable position than they have for a long time, at least on those issues.
In your book, The River of Lost Footsteps, you write about the uprising in 1988. Tell us about that.
By 1988, the military had been in power for a quarter of a century, and it had undertaken a series of disastrous policy decisions in the early 1960s to nationalize all industry, to kick out all foreigners, to isolate the country essentially from the whole world in terms of investment and trade and everything else, and to impose a complete military dictatorship, not just sort of a military dictatorship on top of a normal government, but to really assume direct control over many state institutions. And that led to a disaster economically and in many other ways. And by the late 1980s, I think people were sick of that. And you had, in the summer of 1988, huge pro-democracy or anti-government demonstrations in Rangoon and many other cities, which were finally crushed after about 3 or 4 weeks with great force and leading to the deaths of probably hundreds of people in Rangoon. And that shook the military. It led to a new generation of army officers coming to the fore by the early 1990s. And these guys, the new military leaders, did two things that were different. One was to enter into these ceasefires with their armed opponents in the countryside and up in the hills. And second, open up the economy and try to reform the economy and end the isolation. So they weren't democrats. They didn't want democracy, but they were looking at Thailand, they were looking at South Korea, they were looking at other military dictatorships that were actually moving their country forward in some way. and they were hoping that they could do something like that as well. So it was a watershed in a way in Burmese history that the military was changing this position. But unfortunately, they were not willing to move forward, at least in a meaningful way, on the political front at the same time.
In 1988, when this uprising occurred, where were you?
I had been in Burma earlier that year, and I was outside. I was actually in Geneva working as an intern. I'd finished university recently in Geneva. And when the uprising happened, I tried to go back into Burma, and I wasn't there during the few weeks of the demonstrations. Immediately after the demonstrations were crushed, thousands, probably 8,000 to 10,000 university students and other dissidents fled to the Thai border. Not so much to flee, but to try to regroup. And there was great expectations at that time that perhaps the West would actually arm them, that they could form an army and fight the government. This was at a time of great emotion and passion, given what had happened in Rangoon and other cities as well. And I spent most of that year, in late 1988 and 89, with them on the border and also with refugees in Bangkok.
Let's go to the phones and take some callers. We have Nicola calling us from Middlebury, Connecticut. Nicola, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Miss Page. Miss Page, if your guest could be as kind as to give me a kind of a thumbnail sketch of the history of Burma, how it came to become a nation, what kind of ethnical composition does it have. I remember the Burma Road from World War II. I watched a documentary on PBS about the present political situation, but I don't have it very clear in mind.
Thanks for your call, Nicola.
Thank you. I mean, I think the best thing is to think about Burma as, in some ways, a very old country. You have a monarchy, you had a political tradition, you had a kingdom which roughly fit the borders of present-day Burma at different times, going back well over 1,000 years. And then in the 19th, and this was a very expansionist power, it invaded Thailand several times. It invaded what is now Northeast India in the early 19th century. But over the course of the 19th century, it also started to fight British India and lost a number of wars. And by 1885, the last Burmese king was dethroned by the British, and the British annexed Burma and made it into a province of India, which is what it was through from 1885 through the 1930s. And then in 1941-42, the Japanese invaded the country, and there was a very violent fight over Burma between the Allies and the Japanese, which led to the destruction of almost the entire Burmese economy. And after the war, the British were briefly in charge again, but by 1947, they had decided to quit Burma. And in 1948, they handed over power to a group of nationalists who initially had been collaborating with the Japanese in the early part of World War II, but then had turned against the Japanese at the end of World War II. Now, the Burmese, or the people who speak Burmese, who are largely Buddhist, are roughly two-thirds or more of the population. Burma is one of the most ethnically and linguistically diverse places in the world. There are over 300 different languages and mutually unintelligible dialects. And the next biggest minority group, the Shans, are probably about 8-9% of the population. So the Burmese are about 60-something percent of the population. The minorities together are probably about a third of the population.
Let's go to Fairlawn, New Jersey, and talk to George. George, hi. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I wanted to ask your guest. I have a pen pal who is now back in Myanmar, Burma. And I wanted to know a couple of things. I was interested in communicating with him, but he expressed in some letters and on the computer that it's very difficult with the military government. And the other thing is I was interested in finding out how or if it's possible he wanted to go to Thailand to get an education, which I was willing to help him do. Is it difficult to do these things, translate money and communicate, in my case?
George, let me ask you a question. How did you become pen pals with this person?
I met him on the computer, actually. He was stranded in South Korea, and he was in desperate need. He was being beaten by his coworkers, and his life was threatened. And I helped him get from South Korea to Vietnam and from Vietnam back to Myanmar.
All right. George, thanks for your call. Is it hard to write letters to communicate with people in Burma on the Internet?
It's not hard to write letters to people in Burma. There is more and more internet connections with Burma today, but a lot of that is censored or a lot of that is monitored. And so if it's about, if the letters or the emails involve anything about politics or any sort of criticism of the government, it could very well get the person who's receiving it in trouble on the Burmese side. It is possible to emigrate from Burma, and because of the poverty in the country, thousands, more than thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, perhaps close to 2 million people, have left the country over the last 10 or so years, mostly young people looking for work elsewhere in Asia. So it is possible to go to Thailand to work. Many people go illegally, some go legally, or to study and to get a visa to study in Thailand. So that's possible. I think your friend, your pen pal's story is one of many like that, where because of economic mismanagement, but also I think because of sanctions, the economy in the country is in many ways in poor shape, and lots of people are looking at going abroad in very difficult conditions.
Tanya is calling us from Salt Lake City. Tanya, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Appreciate your call. I mean, your your show. Anyway, I'm going to Burma next week, and there's a conspiracy. Aung San Suu Kyi says, don't visit the country because it just supports the military government. And the other side says, no, do come and, you know, spend money as locally as possible and don't support the government. But I tend to agree with that. I think that makes sense to me. And I'm wondering, is there anything else that someone could do when they're there, you know, to learn more to help the situation out, you know, without getting in trouble or getting someone else in trouble?
Mm-hmm. Tanya, interesting. Are you going there as a tourist?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks for your call.
I'm very much in favor of people visiting Burma. And I think, you know, I think it's very understandable that people say, well, I don't necessarily want to spend my holiday in a repressive country. But I don't think that means it automatically that not visiting is somehow helping a positive change in the country. And my gut feeling when I'm there is that the more tourists there are, the more the country will be opened up. And it's the isolation of the country from the outside world, from people, from contacts, culturally, economically, and in every other ways, is providing the oxygen which allows the kind of repression to continue and allows the status quo to continue and the dictatorship in many ways to continue. So I'm very much in favor of people going. I think I know the tourist industry there in the sense that I've been to many of the hotels and things there. A lot of them are privately run. Almost all of them are privately run. Very few are actually government hotels. I think it's important probably not to stay in a government hotel, but stay in a private hotel. But I think it's just your presence there. I would shy away from trying to engage too many people unless you get to know them very well on political discussions. I would perhaps try to go to parts of the country where tourists don't often go. And I just think that the more people who go, the more people who see the situation for themselves, in a way that, you know, in Spain, for instance, in the Franco time, in the fascist time, there was a whole idea of solidarity tourism, that a lot of people wanted to go to Spain to express their support for the Spanish people and to help them connect with the rest of the world. And I think it's the same attitude that we should have in Burma as well.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls and reading your emails. Let's go back to the phones and take another a caller. Thane is calling us from San Antonio, Texas. Thane, hi. Thanks for joining us on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you very much. I grew up in Burma. I'm from Magui. And I met your grandfather, Uthman, in Rangoon. In Rangoon, when he was the Attorney General. I mean, when he was Secretary General of the United Nations. Do you hear me?
Yes.
We do. That's very interesting. Now, what was the feeling of people in Burma toward this Burmese man who had become Secretary General of the UN? Was he very revered?
He was in Rangoon. I visited him in his home in Rangoon. I just want to ask a couple of questions. I see I'm a graduate of Rangoon University. Is there a Rangoon University now?
Yes, there is a Rangoon University, but since the 1988 demonstrations, the government has tried to to create many other smaller universities so that there isn't a single clearly main university in the capital, which could then become a magnet for political dissent. And sadly, because of 20 or 30 years of, I think, very bad education policies, in many ways, at least at the upper levels of education, at the university levels, the university is not in the same kind of shape that it was in the 1950s.
Yeah, I remember, I know Dr. Taeyang very well. Dr. Taeyang.
Yes.
And in fact, I met him in Rangoon. In fact, it was in your grandfather's house that I met him.
Right.
And they drove away all the educated people. When I was in Rangoon, because I'm an engineer, there was a lot of faculty, Indian and English faculty. They're all gone.
Absolutely. I think that's a very important point. I think people also forget the expulsion of the ethnic Indians in 1964, when 400,000 ethnic Indians were expelled from the country. This is very much like Idi Amin's expulsion of Asians in just a few years later. And I think the caller is very right in pointing out that, you know, Burma had a fairly educated class of professionals by the early 1960s. And one of the disastrous policies of the military in the early 1960s was essentially not using that class, forcing many of those people into exile and pushing the country towards this isolation. And that's part of my argument for why I think anything that now reverses that isolation through contacts and every other way will in the end be a much more effective way of undermining the status quo in Burma than trying to isolate the country further as a form of pressure.
Thane lives in San Antonio, Texas. Are there many Burmese people who have immigrated to the United States? Are there communities that have concentrations of Burmese?
I think there are a few waves of people. There were some people who left in the 1960s and 70s after the military had first taken over, and then there's a much later wave of both people who've come here for economic reasons or to study, but also political refugees and refugees who had come mostly from Thailand, where they had been refugees first and have settled now in the U.S. in different cities.
We're going to take another very short break, and when we come back, we'll discuss what the title means, The River of Lost Footsteps. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. Additional support for NPR comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, featuring a new book by Carl Schramm, The Entrepreneurial Imperative, at kauffman.org. And from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities, on the web at wkkf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The series premiere of the Canadian sitcom Little Mosque on the Prairie, about a group of Muslims living in a Saskatchewan prairie town, got the biggest audience the CBC network has had in 10 years. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the show's creator, Zakhar Nawaz. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page, sitting in for Diane Rehm, and I'm talking in the studio with Thant Mien Yu, who is the author of The River of Lost Footsteps, Histories of Burma. I said before the break I wanted to ask you what this title refers to.
It's actually the name, or the title, The River of Lost Footsteps, was how Rudyard Kipling, the poet, had described the Irrawaddy River, which was the main river in Burma. He had visited Burma in the late 1880s, very, very briefly. He had written the famous poem Mandalay, but he'd only been in Rangoon for a day or something. And he was there as a journalist and partly covering the very bloody British anti-guerrilla pacification campaign against Burmese guerrillas that was being fought in Upper Burma at that time. And he called the Irrawaddy the River of Lost Footsteps because for him it meant the stories of all these British soldiers who had gone up the Irrawaddy and died fighting in Burma, unknown back home and unreported back home. And he was referring to that. I use it in a different way to refer really to the sort of lost histories of Burma, the lost history that people don't often think about when they think about Burma today.
Why did you decide to write this book?
A couple of things. One is I think Burmese history is in itself really interesting and really colorful. I mean, if you look at a map, Burma is at the very crossroads of Asia. I mean, it connects to Chinese history and Tibetan history and Inner Asian history, but it connects west to Indian history and the Islamic world, to Thailand and Cambodia, but then to the whole age of exploration and the Portuguese and the Spanish and the Dutch and finally the English as well. So it's an incredibly colorful history, which I think is almost entirely unknown in this country. And I wanted first to introduce people to that history. But second, because I think the Burma debate today about sanctions, about what to do about the repression and human rights violations in the country, I think very strongly would benefit from a better understanding of Burmese history. So I wrote the book also to try to connect the issues today and the situation today to the broader outlines of Burmese history and what's happened over the last 50 or 100 years as well.
We have an email from Wendy, and she asks, now that Mr. Thantmien U has written this book, would he be able to visit Burma in the future?
Well, I guess we'll have to see. I think, you know, it's sometimes very arbitrary in terms of who the government allows to travel and go into the country and not. But I hope so. I think, you know, in general, the government can be very sensitive to criticism. But, and this is really not a point about me so much, but more generally, I think they make a distinction between those that they feel are simply pursuing a kind of regime change strategy and are out to simply get them and overthrow them in a revolution, and other types of criticism. And I hope that in a way people in the government will actually read this book and also think more carefully about the kinds of policies they're undertaking and also think about Burmese history and what it means for the choices that they have today.
You go to Burma about once a year. Do you visit with people in the government when you're visiting?
No. In general, I just go on a purely personal basis mm-hmm. to see friends and family. But I also try to travel around as much as possible. So I spend some time in Rangoon, but I also go to towns and cities where I have family or even places where I don't have family to try to see how things are going for myself as well.
You mentioned knowing Aung San Suu Kyi when she was a young person and you were growing up in New York. And I wonder, do you ever see her when you're there?
I can't. She's been under house arrest a lot of the time over the past many years that I've been there. But also, because I was in exile from 88 until 96, when she was free and traveling quite a lot of the time in Burma. So I don't see her. I haven't seen her since we met in Oxford in 1986 or 87.
Let's go to the phones and take another call. We'll talk to Carla. She's calling us from Danville, Michigan. Carla, thanks for joining our show.
Yes, I remember back in the 1980s, I believe, that there were two young brothers, along with some other very young men, they were children really, who were fighting against the military establishment at that point. I think they were operating out of Thailand, and perhaps they were Karen tribe. Could you tell me what happened to them?
Sure. It was actually much later than the 1980s. It was actually, I think, in the late 1990s when they were teenagers, and they were a splinter group from the main Karen insurgency, which is in turn one of 18 or 19 different insurgencies in the country. They surrendered essentially to Thai authorities because they were operating right along the Thai border. I guess they're in their early 20s now. The latest I had heard not too long ago, a few months ago, is that one of the brothers had decided to go back to Burma, and the military had allowed him to go back to Burma, and he settled somewhere in Rangoon, I guess, or somewhere else inside the country.
Jared has been very patient holding on. He's calling us from Washington, D.C. Jared, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I just have a brief comment and then a question for your guest. It's been 17 years since the 1990 elections when Burmese pro-democracy groups and the people of Burma, with over 80% of the vote, voted for Aung San Suu Kyi, the NLD, and ethnic groups. And since then, the UN General Assembly and Commission on Human Rights has adopted 29 resolutions calling for national reconciliation, all of which have been ignored. some of the facts about the situation in Burma have not yet been discussed on your show, and I just wanted to mention very briefly that during that whole long period of time since 1990, over a million refugees have been driven out of the country, some 3,000 villages destroyed in ethnic minority areas, 800,000 people involved in forced labor, systematic rape of ethnic minority women, et cetera. I could go on for quite some time. But in the meantime, there has been actually substantial engagement with Burma by the United Nations, as your guest knows better than anybody, by China and a lot of other countries. And it's actually only the United States that actually has strong sanctions in place. And yet your guest calls for more engagement with the junta in lieu of pressure. And I guess my rather pointed question to your guest is that at what point, in his view, should the international community say enough is enough?
You know, Jared, it sounds like you know a lot about this subject. I wonder, are you active on it? Are you involved with it in some way?
Yes, I am.
And how so?
Oh, lots of different ways. I've been to Burma before, and I've also been involved in working with a number of NGOs doing reporting on the situation in Burma.
Interesting. Thant, would you like to respond?
Sure, absolutely. I think that there's a couple of things. One is I agree completely that the human rights abuses that are conducted in the course of counterinsurgency operations are terrible. And I think it's important to monitor what is going on in the southeast of the country on the Karen border, and that the United States, but also the United Nations, should speak out against, in favor of the protection of civilians in that conflict. I think it's important, though, to place it in this broader historical context, where I think, however bad the repression at the center of the country over the last 30 years, the worst human rights abuses, the summary executions, the rape of women in the course of war, the burning down of villages, have happened in the course of these counterinsurgency campaigns. And to the extent that there are ceasefires in the vast majority of the areas where there had been conflict before, I think that ordinary life is better for those people. I think the exception, as I mentioned at the beginning, is in the southeast of the country, where there continues to be counterinsurgency campaigns in the Karen state. I think on the question of sort of engagement things, I'm not so much calling for engagement with the government per se. I think actually that any strategy that is based on trying to either pressure or persuade this Burmese military to change its mind has only a very slim chance of succeeding, because I think it's in the nature of this Burmese military to pursue its own policies in its own course. I don't think it's going to change its mind very quickly, and I think, or very easily under any circumstances. And I think we need to come up with a more creative strategy of trying to outflank them completely and to start to change the kind of society and the environment in which it has been very easy for them actually to stay in power and to keep these policies in place. I think if China and India and all these other countries were willing to involve themselves with the United States and others in a much harder line policy, then perhaps there could be a chance of some success. I would be doubtful even in that case. But as I said before, I think the chance that China would actually take a very hard line and distance themselves from their access to Burmese natural gas and trade in Burma because of human rights and democracy, I think is extremely unlikely at best.
Yeah, I would just note that the engagement you're talking about, particularly economic engagement, I just don't see having much of an impact. I mean, I was in Burma several months ago up near Mandalay. There's this beautiful road that I was just amazed at how beautiful it was. And a nice sign on the road, it's a toll road going from Mandalay to Pinoy Luwin, built by the Chinese government and invested with Chinese dollars. And so there's obviously a lot of investment from China going into Burma, and yet we don't see any change at all in the repression of its own people. And so, you know, as much as I generally would like to support engagement, you know, with any government as a way to try to open up a country, I just don't see the impact. And this is why my question really is, when is enough enough?
Yeah,
when
I think
you say things are unacceptable.
Yeah, I think so. But I think we need to make a distinction between whether we think that it's possible actually to get the Chinese and all these other countries on board in a much harder line policy. And I really don't think that that's possible, in which case what we're left with is a much more harder line policy just by the West, and the West distancing itself more from the country. I think you're right in saying that the kind of trade and investment that there has been, the level of it and the nature of it, has not been conducive to the kind of social and political change that we would want. And I guess that's the debate that I would like to have, is to think through, you know, what is the kind of interactions with Burmese society, either through tourism or through ethical trade or ethical investment, that could perhaps have the right social change. I think there's a lot of homework to be done in thinking that through. But that's the debate that I would like to have, rather than simply thinking about how the West could could take a harder line sanctions when we know that it's very unlikely that the countries in the neighborhood will not follow suit.
Jared, thanks very much for your call and offering us your perspective on that. When it comes to the Bush administration, what has been generally the administration's approach when it comes to Burma? We know, of course, that the United States put forward this UN resolution. What else do you see in terms of U.S. policy?
I think policy in general from the United States and pretty much all and the UK and some other Western countries has been a combination of two things. One is to draw attention to the human rights violations and the political repression and to condemn that bilaterally or through the UN, but also to impose sanctions. And there was a sanctions law that was imposed a few years ago, I think in 2003, which bans any new U.S. investment in the country and financial dealings with the country and things like that. In some ways, there's nothing wrong. I mean, certainly the first thing, drawing attention to the human rights abuses, is a good thing. But I don't think, my main point is that I don't think these things alone are working, and they haven't worked. And I think that we need a much more complex approach to what is a very complex problem. And I would want to place both the human rights situation and the need for a transition to a different type of politics at the center, but together with the need to find a just and sustainable end to the civil war, but also at ways of addressing the poverty in the country, the extreme poverty in the country, and looking at development and humanitarian issues as well.
We have an email from Tim in Athens, Ohio, who says he's already read your book, and he says, I visited Burma as a tourist in December 1986, in the year the nines currency was introduced. What is the nines currency?
It was a very strange thing that happened, which is still, I suppose, slightly inexplicable, when the then dictator General Ne Win decided, because nine was his lucky number, that all the currency denominations would be in denominations divisible by nine. So instead of having the normal 1, 10, 100 currency notes, you had 9, 90, 180, which suddenly meant that, you know, if you were going to go shopping, you had to be really good at math to be able to count, you know, how much money you had and how much things cost. He became a very strange figure at the end and took extreme and increasingly eccentric decisions. He took power in 1962 as still a fairly young man and the head of the Burmese army for many years. And if I could make a sort of general point about the military coming to power in 62, you know, the civil war at that time had already been in place for about 15 years. And it was because of the civil war, and especially the big communist insurgency at the time, that the military built up this huge machine. And General Ne Win was on top of that machine in building it up, and he was able then to take power very easily in 62. He took these disastrous policy decisions that I had mentioned before, but he was himself an unusual figure. There seemed to be a change in the way in which he ruled the country also in the early 1970s. He'd gone, surprisingly, unlike the general today, often on foreign trips. He's an avid golfer. He used to go golfing in Hawaii. He used to go shopping in London. And he had a psychiatrist in Vienna, which he used to see. And I think it's not unreasonable to try to link the end of his, when he stopped his therapy in 1971, 72 with the psychiatrist, and the beginning of a slide towards more eccentricity in the late 1970s and early 1980s.
Does Burma still have nines currency?
No, that was changed very quick. That was changed in 1988. So that just lasted a couple of years around that time.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850. Let's take another one. Drew is calling us from Cleveland Heights, Ohio. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, how are you? Thank you for the show. My question is brief, and that is, after all that happened is in the last 4 or 5 years in the Middle East, do we as the West still have any credibility to criticize these poor countries for what they're doing? And secondly, if their income per capita was $30,000, do you think we would be talking about this issue? And thirdly, who's making and selling the weapons that they use?
All right, Drew, thank you very much for your call.
I'll answer the last part of that first. I think it's a very good question. I think the last part of it is that a lot of the new arms that are coming are mostly from the region, from China and now from India as well, and to some extent from Russia. Burma, though, had very good military relations with almost all major powers until the 1980s, and there was a whole generation of Burmese military officers who had been trained in the United States as well and in the West generally, as well as from other countries in Asia. I think in terms of credibility, you know, I think it's right that Burma is held to the highest standards of human rights, and I think it's fine for the United States as well as the United Nations to and European countries to say that, you know, we would want this sort of standard for human rights in the country. But I think we need to be sensitive to your point, which is that the perception of double standards, and I think at least I think in the Burmese army and in the Burmese political elite today, there is a very strong sense of double standards in judging a country like Burma versus judging a country like China or a country like Vietnam, both of whom are neighbors and have authoritarian regimes as well. I think for many people in Burma itself, though, I think for a long time and perhaps now as well, they welcome the sort of attention from the West to the political problems. But that has had, in some ways, a negative effect as well, in the sense that, you know, in 1988, popular demonstrations came very close to toppling the government, and that was at a time when there was no attention from the outside world. I think in some way the attention has also had the unwitting effect of making people look towards the outside world as a solution for their problems and hope that there might be some kind of intervention from the outside world for ordinary people, rather than actually facing fully the situation in the country and looking at ways in which Burmese people can also change the country themselves.
Your grandfather, U Thant, was Burma's representative to the UN and then served as UN Secretary General from 1961 to 1971. And Jerry sends us an email. He says, I understand U Thant is your grandfather. Would you discuss his impact on your life and your career?
I was very young when he died, so I don't remember having had any long discussions with him on politics or on Burma or on the United Nations. The United Nations was obviously something that was always, you know, a big part of my life in the sense that I remember it from a very early age. One of the very first things I remember is actually when I was probably about 3 years old, a couple of weeks after the first moon landing, when I went to my grandfather's office and met Neil Armstrong and the astronauts who had just come back. And I remember meeting a lot of people at that time at the UN when he was Secretary General and I was very young. It was an accident in some ways, though, that I joined the UN later in my life. I was very interested in Southeast Asia and Southeast Asian history. I had worked for a couple of years with Human Rights Watch, and I had applied and was hired as a human rights officer in Cambodia with the UN peacekeeping operation there in the early 1990s, and that led to other UN jobs. It wasn't really something I intended or was necessarily sort of always planning for.
I want to thank you for joining us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show to discuss your new book, The River of Lost Footsteps, Histories of Burma. Thanks so much for being with
Thank
us.
Thank you.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Ann Adams, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, cassette and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. This is NPR, National Public Radio.